Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And this content that we're providing is literally the primary source documents of how this nation evolved from the British monarchical theocracy into this hybrid constitutional republic. There was still evolution after the Constitution was ratified because all 13 states had screwed up governments, and it required them to, on their own, improve their form of government towards this exemplar that the Constitution created in dividing the power of government into three separate branches. This is a very unique form of a republican form of government. More even unique is the bicameral legislative body, which is what we call American republicanism, because under the basis of a republican form of government, it is the government that is representative of the people and a government that is based on the rule of law, that the law is the supreme being, or the king, that is our monarch, is the law, not a person. Therefore, the American slant, or this new innovation of a republican form of government, is that our legislative body does not represent the people. It represents the sovereigns of the nation, identifying that both the people are sovereign and the government that the people create are sovereign. Now, I know a lot of people have a problem with this, but bottom line, when you create a government and you delegate power to them, you've absolved yourself from being involved in the decisions of purifying the water, of, you know, making the roads and creating standards for the building of the roads and bridges and on and on and on. We don't bother ourselves with that. They're the ones that have been doing that. They've been doing a great job. Or in some cases, they've been kind of ignoring technology, allowing things to get worse and worse because our government has been working against us. But that's a different case. The whole point of American republicanism is we do not represent the people. We represent, our representative bodies represent the sovereigns. The only representative republic that we have where it is commonly just representative of the people is the county. Because at the county level, there is no sub-government that has been created other than in the cities. If you live in the city in that county, you have the county government, then you have the city government. But the cities do not get representation in the county. The cities are just little vestiges of people creating a community where they want to regulate themselves. And the county oversees that to make sure that the cities are, you know, doing good and serving the people, not oppressive, and being, supposedly, they're being in line with the Constitution and governing. But that's been going by the wayside because we've lost sight of our republican form of government, because our counties are no longer really representing the people. Even though we elect them, they're being controlled by the state. They become an administrative arm of the state. Why and how did that happen? Because we, the people, never seize control, because we created that government, and in many ways it was created for us, not by the state, but by the federal government. But still, it being a government, it should have been formed by us, and we should have created a constitution delegating power to that county. So the reason we have this huge problem of maintaining this balance and accountability and everything else is because we have failed to do our job, we the people, in instituting our county government. Folks, I'm telling you, once you do this, once you create a true constitutional county where you have a constitution, and you have your militia, and you have all of these things that are a part of the overall Republican plan that the framers had kind of created, i.e. the militia is a big part of that, and in most of all the states, ensuring that your justice system is absolutely available to you, i.e. common law or civil law, in the states that have, you know, how they've established that justice system, because most of the states have had court systems that have completely, you know, abrogated or actually have completely obviated the our justice system that we're supposed to have. They've created this central power of assuming jurisdiction over all things. Anyway, long story short, let me just get to the content. What we're here is we're providing you all of the facts so that you can start getting involved in doing what's necessary. What's necessary is creating constitutional compliance committees at the county level. This will lead you eventually to recognize how important it is to have a county constitution. And once you get enough counties in your state, that everybody, reasonable people equally formed seldom disagree, which is why every state is going to start recognizing the importance of having constitutions for their counties and then rewriting their state constitution to properly adjust the power distribution to basically allow the counties and the people to have most of their power. Because the constitutions are what authorize government to function. And constitutions come from we the people or our the delegates of the counties or the delegates of the people of those areas of government, such as the state. The federal constitution was created by delegates from the state. The state constitutions were created by delegates from the counties. Ergo, folks, we just need to start getting things straight in assuming control over our government. So with all of that, it's all about learning these things and then start praying. Actually, learn, pray, act so that we can all start understanding the importance of revitalizing our Republican form of government in this hybrid constitutional republic. It's a hybrid constitutional republic because there should be a constitution at each layer of the republic. The base layer of this hybrid constitutional republic is the counties. The next layer of the republic is the republic of the state. You've got a republic of the county, a republic that we call the state, and then we have this large republic that we call the union, or, you know, the different states in that republic. Because when you look at the Senate is kind of that place of representing the government of the republic. And the House is representing the people of those states of the republic. So anyway, I digress. I wanted to get moving forward into this Combined States Act, authorizing the election of delegates for the 1787 Constitutional Convention. Again, this document is available on the Academic Source Documents page on reclaimingtherepublic.org. Now we've got Tammy and we've got Sean with us today. So welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here, sir.
All right. And Tammy, I heard you garble in underneath him, so it sounds like you're there. And welcome back. It's been a little while. We've missed you. We missed Sean last week, and we missed you this week. And you know, I just want you to know that you're the beloved of this show. I'm just the facilitator, or maybe I'm the, what do you want to call it? The host. I'll just leave it with that because I'm trying to think of a better word for it in English, but you know, I could have said the dominator or the guy that
I'm like Grand Poobah.
The Grand Poobah. Well, you know, sometimes I know that I can start rattling and going on and on, and it's really that's not my intention. But there's information that I think sometimes is critical, but it has been proven over, you know, the course of having both of you as guest hosts or, you know, being a part of the show, that your paradigms are, one, very insightful, and it's valued because not everybody sees things the way GR sees things. And so the questions you ask are basically, you know, questions that many other people say, yeah, that, you know, I'm glad you asked that question. So anyway, working in a vacuum and just doing monologues and reading and so forth makes a very boring show, but actually having and sharing and so forth makes this a very educational and insightful show. Now, what we were covering yesterday, or actually last Friday, Tammy, was the New York Enabling Act for sending the delegates to the convention. And we covered both the House and then the Senate's resolutions of what needed to be done or who was going to do what and so forth. And the question I posed back to Sean was, it seems to me that there are some confines that, you know, there's these nuances that kind of create, I want to say, of confines. So let me go ahead and read this again. Resolved, if the honorable the assembly concur herein, that three delegates be appointed on the part of this state to meet such delegates as may be appointed on the part of the other states respectively on the second Monday in May next at Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Now, this is the first state enabling act that actually laid that for the sole and express purpose. And in some ways, I kind of missed this. Do you not agree, Tammy? I mean, does that not seem like that?
I don't remember.
Yeah, that kind of comes across like, you know, we just want you to revise the Articles of Confederation. And reporting, in other words, going through and revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and to the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress, and confirmed. So in other words, they're going to come back either with revised Articles of Confederation or amendments to the Articles of Confederation that will, one, be agreed to by Congress and then by the states. And so, and confirmed by the several states, render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the government. In a way, this kind of seems like we're expecting to see the Articles of Confederation again. And what they did do is they actually completely changed the form of government from a magistrate and basically broke asunder the magistrate paradigm and created three separate branches. Never done ever before. This was a new thing that Madison injected. But bottom line is, I think that there is merit in saying that New York expected a very specific product. Now, when we go into, because the next thing we're going to cover after we cover these few states that we may actually start covering today is the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. So as we dive into that, we're actually going to see how they've kind of brought forward as the delegates from all the different states, and everybody agreed that they had the impossible task. There was no saving the Articles of Confederation. It was so defunct. There were certain parts of it that were solid that were actually integrated or basically became the baseline for the Constitution. Madison says in the Federalist Papers that they did a word-for-word, you know, integration. You look at the exact same clause that is in the Articles is in the Constitution. They did what they could to do this, but one of the things that they did was they really organized this. And let me just stop on this. Because when we start looking at every state constitution, it boggles my mind why every state did their constitution the way they did, instead of actually following the federal constitution by having Article 1 being the article of your legislative body. Most all states started off with the declarations of rights. And I go, well, I guess that makes everybody feel good, but and back in the 1800s, after the 14th Amendment, if you created a constitution after the 14th Amendment, the necessity of declaring rights of the people is not necessary. It's redundant because the supreme law of the land, the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, Section 1, states that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. So why bridge those unless you're adding more privileges and immunities that are not guaranteed by that Constitution, the U.S. Constitution? And if you really look at it, I think that some states have tried to do that, but in a way, I don't think that they really necessarily succeeded, but I could be wrong. because we have to go through these things with a fine-tooth comb and really determine, did they at that point in time acknowledge a new technology, something new or an action or something the government was going to then do that wanted to make sure that the rights of the people couldn't be infringed upon by something now the government had never done before, like infrastructure. Now, that not that infrastructure wasn't done by Rome, but some of the infrastructure, like, you know, because they had waterways, highways, and so forth, but not railways. They didn't have, you know, those types of things, airways. So when we started adding airports, those types of things. So the question goes back to, why didn't these counties, when they sent the delegates to create the states, why didn't they go with Article 1 laying out the specific powers? And this is why, when you start reading the state constitutions, you're going to get the same frustration I have. I'm not trying to help people say, well, I'm not going to do it then because I don't want to be frustrated. I mean, who wants to inflict pain upon themselves? Right? Who wants to, oh, hey, I woke up today in the mood to be frustrated. When we look at the state constitutions versus the U.S. Constitution, in Article 1 of the Constitution for the United States, the powers are definitively listed right there in Section 8. These are the powers that we're granting Congress or the state legislature. You can meddle with this, 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 and this. Wouldn't it be nice if your state constitution was done in the same format? Not rhetorical. What do you think? Do you think that having a definitive list of these are the powers delegated? So in other words, if you agree, then when we create an amendment to the state constitution that we're going to delegate power, you know, regarding because of, you know, the advancements and so forth, let's say education. Education was really not something that states were even involved in. They weren't in any of the constitutions until much later. And so, okay, now we're going to inject education. So now the requirement, if the state is going to have that, that power would be then injected into that Article 1, Section 8, or into that list of powers. And so that everybody could clearly see how those powers were delegated, not in some separate, you know, amendment tucked at the very bottom with this language that 9 times out of 10 people just don't even read through that. My point is if, yeah, if we actually did a better job in writing and maintaining our state constitutions, it would be a lot easier to definitively say our state has these powers. They can do this, 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 and this. And our state is basically executing all of these powers. And this, 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 and this, they have no authority to do because they're not within those powers that are listed. Now it makes it easy for us to kind of look at, if we make our constitutions in a way that anybody can start looking at them and clearly understanding, hey, there's the powers. I don't see that power listed, what you're talking about with the environment here. You know, it's important, but you can't create these laws and take away our ability to do logging or something because some erosion factor or what have you. Anyway, so what is everybody's idea regarding New York possibly having a little tighter restriction other than just a blank check like most of the other states? You agree, Sean?
No, because it says to revise. Uh-huh. And I mean, that could mean anything. Do whatever you need to do to make it fit what they were talking about. So they're revising it to make it adequate to the exigencies of government and preservation of the union.
I'm not saying that it's an ironclad, hey, you came back with something that was absolutely wrong. What I'm saying is the language is a little bit different because the other states said devise and design, you know, the solution, you know, and bring that back. What I read here is basically going out and kind of concocting what they would recommend, coming back with the recommendations, not with the final product. Anyway,
I don't see any language okay. in there. I mean, maybe I'm reading different, but right, the sole and express purpose part,
yeah,
I think it just I don't think it narrows their ability to deal with the issues. I think it just gives them a focus.
Okay.
On this is what you're going there to do, is to fix this.
Okay.
I don't think it puts limits on them.
No, that's fine. I just wanted, so for full disclosure, I don't want anybody to think that the John Birchers have gotten to me and have twisted my arm and said, you know, we're going to take your grandkids on a trip that you'll never see them again if you don't start lightening up on us. That's not happened. Okay. So I'm just trying to make sure.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
So I'm just trying to make sure that the GR is trying to be as objective as possible to see it the way they're basically reporting it, that this was a runaway convention. This language kind of lays it out to say, hey, but bottom line, this is where the notes on the Constitutional Convention, because I'm going to prove to you, the listener, that in the notes in the Constitutional Convention, they constantly regroup themselves to say, hey, hold on here. We do have this responsibility that the states have sent us here to do. Are we going beyond that? And I think the ultimate conversation constantly recurs back to this idea that the articles are there. There's no way they can resuscitate them in forming a proper government. That based on the information and the enlightenment that they've received through forming this new form of government in a grander scale of republicanism with checks and balances and so forth, what they're doing is they're coming in. And as Washington said, and Congress basically stated this in the very first Thanksgiving address, that under the tranquility of peace, that the divine hand of providence was able to inspire these men to create such a beautiful constitution that was designed to protect and basically ensure that the liberties of the citizens of this great nation could not be truly disturbed without being subverted, perverted, and a lot of things happen to basically put this nation going sideways. And if that's true, because look at, I mean, we've survived and we still have the best liberty, and not, that's not saying much, but it's still the rigors that this Constitution has gone through, the abuses and attacks and so forth. And yet, at any tomorrow, the state legislatures, if everybody finally agreed on full compliance with the Constitution, we could have this constitutional framework right back and have the government that was designed back functioning again. That this government that we have is not a permanent government. It's a facade. It can be crumbled and basically swept away, going back to the limited and defined government that quickly. That debt clock would end up going away. We wouldn't owe that money. We would no longer be incurring debt. And that the states would now have, and the people would now have, the resources of being able to do things for themselves. If they want to have, you know, these types of services that the federal government should not be involved in, then they can do those things. But anyway, all right. So I just wanted to make sure that I was trying to, you know, be perceived as going overly fair, because, you know, I have a reputation of poking people in the eye. And I just wanted to make sure that because the language was a little bit different in this one. Just pointing it out. Okay, so moving forward, we only have 25 seconds, and then we got, you know, a little extension of the break here, but going forward, we're going to go into Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania has a few different paragraphs, and we want to kind of read these, but what we want to do is kind of more prepare for the break. So both of you, if you've got any go-backs before we dive into Pennsylvania, just let me know when we come back from the break, any other points or what have you, or actually, if you want to dig in and, you know, poke other people, you know, like the Eagles Forum or what have you, in the eye, along with the John Birchers, by all means, let me know, or just go ahead and feel free to do so when we come back. Because the whole point is we're trying to distill what the real truth is. Was it a runaway convention? And I believe we're giving you all the evidence. There's no evidence that it was. No evidence that it was. These men were very disciplined in trying to provide a great product. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I kind of posed it out there going into the break that you're all more than welcome if you wanted to, you know, throw your two cents or, you know, put your finger into somebody's eye. By all means, you're more than welcome. This is an equal opportunity eye-poking program. So, anywho, anything?
Ladies first.
Ladies first. Okay.
I don't have anything.
Oh, come on.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
The people, I want to poke an eye.
This topic, I don't have anything.
Okay. All right. Because, well, we've talked about this before, Tammy, how the whole nation during legislative session, the kickoff of legislative session, goes into this stranglehold of a binary conversation that either we have to hold this convention or we don't hold the convention and do nothing. Or lately, the John Birchers have said, well, we need to nullify. And all these areas are basically saying, well, we need to nullify. And actually, the way they present nullification, it's almost like this magical thing that the paper that we write the laws on have these unnatural physics in the laws of physics, the ability to liquefy and expunge the ink that doesn't belong on the paper if it needs to be nullified. In other words, we're going to be protected by this magical paper because we're going to call for nullification. It just happens. Nullification cannot just happen. You can call and say, hey, this needs to be nullified. But until you actually state the case through interposition and holding people accountable, nothing will happen. Nullification is just a nice, you know, multi-syllable word that makes people go, what does that mean?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's actually something that I've learned through going, you know, I've learned with you going through all this process that nullification is not the answer, and that you actually have to state, you know, the states need to come together or the people and say, hey, that's wrong.
Right.
You can't do this, and actually have a organized way to do that and tell them to stop.
Right. We have to act. We have to organize in our action so that we methodically succeed in getting compliance to our Constitution. Yes, absolutely. Sean.
I just wanted to reiterate last. That I thought that what you were talking about and what I see here, what we're going through, it's funny how before, during the war, during the Revolutionary War, they were kind of able to make things work and get things done, but they didn't start really having a lot of problems, and the problems didn't become as evident as once the war was over and they were at peace. You know, and that kind of goes to the same thing of people, once the war is over and their survival was not insured, but, you know, pretty much the victory was won, then everybody started worrying about themselves, and then everything started getting out of control, and the government couldn't do what it needed to do to preserve the union and do what it needed to do. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Okay. So
interesting
issue.
Okay, so help clarify, which war are you talking about? The Vietnam War?
Revolutionary War.
Oh, the Revolutionary War. Okay, so we kind of mentioned this earlier, last week, that there was a huge difference in how the nation ended that war and basically purged its ranks through expelling the Tories. In other words, if you were a loyalist and you were perceived as an enemy, we got rid of you. The Civil War, they didn't do that necessarily because, you know, it was a little bit more of, you know, a conflict between slavery and freedom. And so I just wanted to make sure that, you know, in the revolution and actually in taking our government back, when we talk about this whole accountability, we need to actually hold citizens accountable for, you know, these people that are convincing sovereign citizens to basically unplug, get out and stay away, you know, become a part of, because they're a part of the problem. We need all hands on deck demanding accountability to the Constitution. And these people are just turning their backs on us and walking away. I believe that the people that are instigating this, Anna von Ritz and the rest of her minion that are out there promoting this idea of not paying taxes and self-serving yourself and don't worry about what happens, they're basically abandoning us, and I believe that they need to be taken out too, or deported as well, because they are contributing to the problem. Bottom line, the litmus test is this. As a U.S. citizen, we are all under oath or legal obligation under our birthright to defend and support this Constitution. When I say this Constitution, I'm talking about the original Constitution and all of its ratified amendments. All of these people that are making hay about all these amendments are all bad, blah, blah, blah. There's no boogeyman in those amendments. It was the acts and other things that were done later that created these vestiges of unconstitutional governance, bureaucracies, so forth and so on. Bottom line, these people who are not supporting the Constitution and choosing to actually take people out from supporting the Constitution, they're just as equally evil and they're just as equally bad and an enemy to our state as those who are literally out in the streets demanding communism now. And so as far as I'm concerned, they can all be deported together and then they can sort it out. Because we don't need people, because those people, if we let them stay, these state nationalists and so forth, those leaders of those types of groups, if we allow them to stay, they're going to continually try to convince that, oh, even this is bad. They're going to find other ways to become dissenters. Haters will always hate. Lovers of liberty will always love liberty. At least I like to think that. I think you can trodden and beat and abuse somebody to a point where, you know, they have a distaste for anything. You know, a dog who loves their owner, you know, will over time and enough abuse actually, you know, bite their owner. So, anywho. All right. Well, let's move forward then. And here we go into Pennsylvania. And so there's a few different sections here. We got sections 1, 2, and 3. And so, Tammy, let's go ahead and start off with. And actually, you know, I was looking for the court, and so I had to type that court. I missed this. So Connecticut was a state that referred to their assembly as a court. The other state that refers to their assembly as a general court or like a Supreme Court is New Hampshire. So I missed that. I should have highlighted that. I realized that, shoot, we've gotten far enough to where, you know, I think we passed it, and we did. But I wanted to point out this paradigm that when you look at a legislative body in our Republican form of government, that legislative body functions as both a court, which is a judge and jury. In other words, they're the ones that create the laws, and they're the ones that will actually deem and determine whether those laws are onerous. Well, if they're truly serving us, They will do right by us by getting rid of bad laws. They will make sure that the laws that they create are not, they're not immune from, that everybody, they apply to all. good, I'll just say good people that are, you know, following the spirit of the Constitution and under the auspices of this land of liberty, you know, if we have those types of public servants, we're going to be taken care of because they're going to be held accountable if they don't. That's the catch, folks. You got to hold them accountable. We've gone 200 years of just letting them run amok. About time to reel them in, don't you think? Before we just actually go off the cliff? Okay. So, Tammy, let's go ahead and read Section 1, and then Sean can read Section 2. So, go ahead.
All right. Whereas the General Assembly of this Commonwealth, taking into their serious consideration the representations heretofore made to the legislatures of the several states in the Union by the United States and Congress assembled, and also weighing the difficulties under which the Confederated States now labor, are fully convinced of the necessity of revising the federal Constitution for the purpose of making such alterations and amendments as the exigencies of our public affairs require. And whereas the legislature of the state of Virginia have already passed an act of that Commonwealth empowering certain commissioners to meet at the city of Philadelphia in May next, a convention of commissioners or deputies from the different states and the legislature of this state are fully sensible of the important advantages which may be derived to the United States and every of them for cooperating with the Commonwealth of Virginia and the other states of the Confederation in the said design.
Okay, so that's interesting. They're highlighting Virginia, kind of holding, an exemplar, you know, they're being a good example by moving forward and doing this. So go ahead, Sean, let's do Section 2.
Being enacted, and it is hereby enacted by the representatives of the freemen of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in General Assembly met, and by the authority of the same, that Thomas Mifflin, Robert Morris, George Clymer, Jared Ingersoll, Thomas Fitzsimmons, James Wilson, and Governor Morris, Esquires, are hereby appointed deputies from the state to meet in the convention of the deputies of the respective states of North America, to be held at the city of Philadelphia on the second day of the month of May next, and the said Thomas Mifflin, Robert Morris, George Clymer, Jared Ingersoll, Thomas Fitzsimmons, James Wilson, and Governor Morris Esquires, or any four of them, are hereby constituted and appointed deputies from this state, with powers to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by the other states to assemble in the said convention at the city aforesaid, and to join with them in devising, deliberating on, and discussing all such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal Constitution fully adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and in reporting such acts or acts for that purpose to the United States and Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states, will effectually provide for the same.
Okay, so that one, again, not the New York nuance, but that one right there, am I right or wrong? That to me seems like a blank check. Tammy, what do you think? You're muted.
Yeah, actually, I'm not.
Oh, okay. You're reading through it. That's fine.
Yeah.
She's deliberating.
Yes, and devising a response.
Right.
And it does say, and further provisions as may be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty blank.
Okay, so, all right, Sean.
I just find it coincidental, not coincidental, but kind of a point that they all pretty much say federal constitution, and then what we ended up with was the Constitution of the United States. So.
Well, so a federal, you got to remember that at this point in time they were a hardcore confederation. So what's the difference between a confederated government and a federal government? Most people don't know this, and that's a good question to bring up.
Just off the top of my head, I would think that a confederate is they're all getting together to make the government that's going to rule or be over them, whereas a federal government is created by the people to rule the whole group, the exigencies of the union.
Okay, now I'm glad you answered for both. Now, what I'd like you to do is, while I give you a response, look up in the definition of a confederation and look up the definition of a federation, because most people talk about federalism and federation, because a confederation is a body of states that have come together and united into a union and have created a general government with very limited power. A federation is where a body of states come together and provide the federation or a general government all powers. In other words, they're creating a general government that has general powers to basically fulfill all of the needs of the federation, where a confederation, they only feed, you know, the strategic or the defense needs or what have you. In other words, the big key is a limited and defined confederation is a very limited general government, where a federation has, you know, an amazing amount of powers to almost be endless. Do you see that?
Right. I had it kind of backwards.
That's okay. That's okay, though, because most people today think we have a federal government and a federation. And that's why I keep on hearing, even in the heartland, all sorts of people with this love for federalism. Oh, it's all in the spirit of federalism. Hold on here. Our framers were not in love with federalism. Actually, the term was confederalism that I actually found in Thomas Jefferson referring to the Union as a confederation while he was president. Because it was clear that the general government was very limited and defined. I mean, he states this very clearly in his Kentucky resolutions. So they understood this. So how did it get out of the bag and get, you know, how did this thing grow into a federation and federalism instead of a confederation and confederalism? Almost in our vernacular, and if you actually said confederalism, people would look at you, that word doesn't exist. And actually, it does. We've just been so programmed to believe that our federal government is, you know, the one-stop shop of taking care of all of our governing needs. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, all right. So with that, I will, you know, defer to Tammy. Any comments other than that on confederalism and federalism, because they do talk about this federal constitution, and this federal government is another word for a general government, not a federation. It's just a word for another word for a general government. A confederation and federation are two literally different formations of governing bodies of sovereign states coming together.
Right.
So this is why I covered in Why Counties Matter Most a generic look at forms of government. In the last article, or in because I got two articles coming, I really dive into the different layers of government so people can actually start understanding the nuances between what these words really mean and what do we really have and what was really the original design. Were we designed as a confederation, or were we designed as a federation? Because most people today would hands down tell you we're a federation, and they're wrong.
That's true, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and what I found was that was why the South called themselves a confederacy, is because their whole sticking point was that they're autonomous republics, and the government only had specific purposes that it was created for, the federal government. And that's why they use Confederate instead of federal states of America.
Yeah, so they were trying, because
opposition right. to the central government being supreme.
Right, so by the time the Civil War occurred, the cat is out of the bag that the Department of Interior had been created, or the Department of Home. That's what they called it back then, the Department of Home. And it basically was this vestige of all unconstitutional powers in maintaining and controlling things called public lands, all unconstitutional. Everything about the Department of Home was all unconstitutional. And so as they were separating, they were basically, you know, saying we want to get back to a true confederation based on the design of the original Constitution. And when you look at what they invoked for their governing document for the Confederation, it wasn't anything like the Articles of Confederation, but it was something very similar to the limited and defined U.S. Constitution. But they were going back to a confederation. There's a reason why history books obscure the reality of these forms of government, what they were doing and what was happening, because they don't want to expose you to the truth that we're supposed to have a very limited and defined confederation and not this federation of all power. We can do anything and everything. So anyway,
I find it striking that, and it's one of those conundrums that I've dealt with since I was old enough to think this way, is that if it wasn't for the issue of slavery, then it would be a whole different history. And we may have not have evolved to the point of corruption we are now. You know what I mean? But they were able to use slavery as their kind of hiding behind that to make the federal government supreme over the states.
You know what? So that is one very key point of this melting pot that we had to purify of. We had this problem, right? It was built into, and we inherited it from the design of the monarch of Britain. Okay, but we also inherited another problem. We inherited a division of religion, because the king, going through the history, the king said, I'm going to change our religion, and instead of actually convincing everybody to slowly evolve in that direction, like Martin Luther, where everybody got united in getting away from the Catholic Church on truly grounds of spiritual nature instead of convenience and opportunity, right? So the king literally created this huge, you know, conflict of religious doctrines. By going down that path, he opened the door for all of these different factions to start rising up. And America became the landing point for all of these little organizations like the Puritans going to Massachusetts. You know, I had a hard time sleeping last night. One of the little things that I had a hard time sleeping about was the Puritans and looking at, you know, it comes to me that the most righteous position in politics, governing, and communal communication with all, you know, with each other, the most righteous position is liberty for all. In other words, we believe, or the Constitution was designed to guarantee liberty for all, not liberty because of your faith. And so, because there are people out there that create this big caste, this divide to say, this nation was made for, you know, in other words, liberty that was, you know, that is available in this nation was designed for good Christian righteous people only. And I disagree. I believe that just like, you know, our Lord and Savior went into the den of iniquity, calling upon people to recognize their sin and walk away from it. In other words, the gospel wasn't just for those people who are righteous. The gospel was for all people. And yeah. I believe that this concept of liberty for all, today it's kind of like that litmus test. If you believe in liberty for all, then, you know, we're working together shoulder to shoulder. If you have this inkling or this sub paradigm, the subcontext of what you're doing is a motive that you really want liberty for your faith. You're kind of fighting in the cause of liberty, but you really want liberty just for your faith, then you become, you know, very limited. And so this, what came to me as I was thinking about Liberty for All, is as I looked at the different states in the Union, the one state that seemed to be humbled, I mean deliberately humbled, was the Puritans. They were first attacked, and they had these problems. They had the Shay Rebellion. I mean, they had real problems up there. They had good men, Samuel Adams and so forth. But it seemed like their paradigm, because they were so good, because they lived such a good, clean life, and their life standards was above everybody, they let that go to their heads. When we look at the foundation of this nation, what was the one state that played the biggest role in the direction of this nation?
Virginia.
Virginia. The first five presidents, out of the first five presidents, right? Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and then Monroe, four of them were Virginians. And then the next president, the first president, or the second president coming from Massachusetts, and then the sixth president, what have you, Adams, John Quincy Adams, so two of that lineage. So my point is this, is that, you know, Virginia was recognized by the good people of America as being that exemplar of what they wanted America to be, a land of liberty for all. And when you really look at the, you know, the Adams were good people. I don't like to be disparaging. You know, John Quincy Adams was much like his father, but he was not nearly as abrasive as his father was. I mean, he was far more polite and, you know, amenable and working with other people, where John Senior was, boy, he was kind of rough around the edges, but he was kind of an old codger, kind of, you know, very steeped in his opinions. The point is that they weren't very open to, you know, consensus and what's the best for all. They had their ideas, and this was why Alexander Hamilton was able to manipulate and get outcomes out of John Adams that he couldn't have gotten out of Jefferson, Madison, and the rest of them. John Adams, because he was baked, all Hamilton needed to do was give him solutions that would meet or look like they're going in the direction of what John Adams would want. And ergo, you know, he basically did the appointments of judges. He did things. He signed off the Alien Sedition Act. Those types of things that Hamilton was basically stirring in the background, Adams was a victim of, because he was predictable, because he was arrogant, because he thought he was better. Madison was definitely not an arrogant man. Monroe, I don't know. But, you know, the point is this, is that, you know, when we really look at what was really the pivotal direction and what saved America was really the state of Virginia and the paradigm that was coming from the Virginians, not from the Massachusetts. So did the good Lord, here's my final question that you can think of, did the good Lord inspire Virginia to actually set the tone for the rest of the nation and not Massachusetts, instead of humbling Massachusetts as he did? We can bring this up next time, and I'll try to remember, so that way we can actually have the discussion on that, because I honestly see Virginia as the exemplar state. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.